Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi.
It's a new year, but of course, time is just a convention, it's just a concept. Our ancestors, the faraway ancestors, they just lived and did their work and looked for food and kept their families together and passed away. And there's no record of them, maybe except their bones. So we are so caught in time, but we're also caught in concepts. And maybe time is the most obvious one. We're having a new year in the West, but there are many new years around the world, and even those years are not completely on the same moon day. I'm not 100% sure, but there are different New Year celebrations. There's nothing wrong with wishing happy New Year to all beings everywhere, even if they want to point a gun at you. Isn't that the nature of developing wholesomeness? In the Metta Sutta itself, we are told to send metta to all beings, even if they're hostile, or even if they have violent intentions towards us. Can we hold a good feeling towards them? Very difficult. That's why we practice. So, beyond the conventions, it's really good for us to practice good feelings to everyone as much as possible, every day, not just wait for New Year. I know for myself, I had doubts about some people that were very hostile to us when we first established the hermitage here. And somebody actually ran up to our property when the temple was being built and was yelling at the builders for building it. I don't think that they actually knew what it was going to be, but the fact that we were building something rather large was very disturbing. And so I went for a walk with this person in our forest, and I said to her, "I'm so sorry that something which is bringing joy to a lot of our community is making you sad and upset." And it did, it helped to deflate her anger. And since then, we've had good communication. But you have to work at these things. It isn't good to keep walls up, even towards people who have a lot of bad feeling for us. And the reason for that is because it just perpetuates the hatred. It perpetuates ill will. It perpetuates suffering. I think what we want to do so much in this practice, the reason that many of us started it in the first place, was probably because the perpetual suffering that we were experiencing in life was unmanageable. And the Buddha has given us these wonderful tools to manage, not only to manage, but to free ourselves from this suffering. I want to emphasize the importance of paying attention to our suffering. We don't deny suffering. Quite the opposite. This teaching is all about the Four Noble Truths of suffering. It hinges on the Four Noble Truths. It circles the Four Noble Truths. They are the beginning and end of the path to awakening. If we deny suffering, that's what ostriches do. They put their heads in the sand and they hide their heads, bury their heads in the sand. We don't want to do that. We want to face the reality, whatever we have to face in life. So what's familiar to us is what we know and understand deeply, and what we know and understand deeply can be a teaching for us. That's why we want to know our suffering, because we want to know the true condition of our being. What are we? Do we know what we are? Do we know who is this I? Who are we? We do start to know when we meditate. And meditation is a way of following the middle way. Meditate means comes to the middle, but it also means to ponder and contemplate, to study, to know deeply. And the deep knowing is by quieting the mind, but it's not any kind of a mind that can meditate. It has to be a mind that is still, that is quiet, that where the ego falls flat on its face, so to speak, because there's no one there, but we have to discover that. So by the mind becoming silent and going towards the silence, then we can find the space between our thoughts, the space between the breaths, the ending of thought, the ending of a breath. What is inside that ending? To know that arising and the ceasing of it is to know how the mind stops and where it stops. Is there a where? It's not a place. It's just into the emptiness of how things really are, just what is. With what is, without our insertion of a self into everything, we insinuate our egos into all our experience. We seem to learn this, or we gain this as we get older. And maybe that's why we get very fond of babies or very small children. It's difficult to hate a baby, isn't it? Because they don't seem to be molded or set in that self-view as older beings are. Where it becomes, you know, when children start saying, mine, it's mine, you know, the toy. Mine, me. And then we get stuck there forever. That's what we have to overcome and let go of more and more, is that creating this centeredness around a being that is not real. It's just a creation. Taking refuge is actually a way of giving that up, or beginning to give that up. Because what we're looking for refuge in is something that is true, and this self is not true. But to get perspective on it, we have to empty the mind of all its concepts. And standing in the middle of this timelessness, where time is no longer what we're fixated on, self we're not fixated on, we're trying to gain access to that deepest recess within ourselves, where these concepts don't insinuate themselves, and where we can abide without concept. And that can be scary because it's unknown. But that's exactly what's needed to reflect in the mirror of emptiness, is to see the nothingness of all that we hang on to. And the reason that it's nothing is because it is impermanent. It has no substance in and of itself, and it's not what we are. So when we're looking for answers to our questions, the most beautiful answer is the silence. I was reflecting recently, we had a gathering here, and I reflected on how when I first met my teacher in India, a great mendicant sage, and I was so happy to be able to visit his temple. And my mind filled with questions. And all I met sitting in his presence was silence. Absolute silence. My mind couldn't find a single thing to hang itself on. It was just empty, just complete peace, a lovingness, a field of empty, compassionate peace. And I sat there, and of course he found the whole thing very amusing. And he teased me and he said, "Do you have any questions?" But he knew perfectly that I couldn't ask a thing. When we encounter that silence in another being, it's quite profound. And I had the inkling right then that I wanted that. I wanted to know that. How does the mind go to that kind of space where it's no longer grasping for the next hit or for the next exciting experience or the next vacation or the next wonderful friend that will influence our life? So the Dhamma, the truth of the way things are, the revelation of that silence within us is a profound, most profound knowing, an awareness of truth that each of us can bring forth from within us. That would probably be the most fruitful and most beneficial blessing that we could know. To know the possibility of that, the potential of that seed bearing fruit within us, is truly a treasure. That's why we come here. We want this. The world doesn't have it. Nothing of the world really has it. That's why we go to the silence. We have these yearnings, these questions. We want freedom. And we can see that whatever you get in the world, it never satisfies us. So the Buddha taught us anicca, dukkha, anatta. So everything is impermanent, it's suffering, it's unsatisfactory, and it's empty of any self. Then to really learn that and know it, we have to find that space within us where we can see it and realize it directly. And this path of practice is just that. It's a practice of taking refuge in that truth, knowing that that possibility exists, and training the mind more and more to realize it, to taste it. So we might be on the mountain, so to speak, or crossing the desert, and we have to keep walking. We know that there is an oasis to be found. It's within our reach, and we follow the directions. We follow the Buddha's instructions, realizing that whatever we pick up from the world is anicca, dukkha, anatta. And then whatever we experience in our meditation, if it's anger, know it for what it is. If it's grief, know it for what it is. If it's joy, know it for what it is. Because even the joy is impermanent. It's not who we are, and it's empty. And that's what upekkha is really about. That state of balance, where we're neither taken aback or enthralled by excitement or happiness, nor are we deflected and downtrodden by some horrific loss. But all of these experiences We take them, we receive them, we know them for what they are, and we keep walking through that desert. It's as if there's a desert. The world is full of what? It's full of greed, it's full of hatred, it's full of beings that are misled, confused, misdirected, who do not understand the importance of purifying the mind. And in fact, will use their skills, their functions, their abilities, their talents, their strength of body and mind to gain things in the wrong way, to satisfy the senses in exaggerated ways, as if all of that would somehow bring some form of permanent happiness. But it's a fiction. It's a theater. It's not the way to the knowing of that which can really fulfill us. And we're here for that. But in order to understand what is true, we have to empty ourselves of what is not true. That's why we work with the hindrances. It's just like here in the monastery, we do a lot of cleaning. Some people come here and they think we're obsessive cleaners. Ajahn Chah himself said that you can tell the quality of a monastery by how clean the toilets are. So we have a few toilets here, and we do spend a lot of time cleaning the buildings, the toilets, the windows, the floors, everything, our clothing, our shoes, our bodies. But the mind has to be cleaned. If the mind is not cleaned, you could have a very beautiful, spacious hall, lovely furnishings, great comfortable mats and cushions to sit on, a fabulous shrine, and all the rest of it. You could have the nicest robes in the world, the cleanest looking shaved head, and all of that. But if the mind is impure, what is the use of all that adornment? They're just extras. We really have to take care of the mind. And the care of the mind is exactly that. It's just the way we care for the buildings. We want them to be as clean as if the Buddha were about to walk in. The Buddha himself is coming. You get excited. Wow, let's make this place really beautiful. But then we want the Dhamma. But the Dhamma can only come through the mind. That's the entry point. It's the mind is where? It's in the heart. How does the Dhamma, the Buddha being the Dhamma, enter into the heart? That has to be open. An open heart is nothing less than a heart that is awake to the truth. So our heart might not be as open as we would like, and that's why we practice, to open it more and more. And the way of opening it is to be real about what's in front of us. This hurts. This person has been mean, unfriendly, hostile. What do we give back to that? What are we used to giving back? Let's not learn from what the world is doing. Kill, fight, destroy, annihilate, ignore, throw a grenade. You know, a wrong word can be just as damaging to a being as if you were throwing a bomb. I don't mean the physical. I mean, it's a relational bomb. It's a heart bomb. It's destructive. Why do we carry around hateful feelings? And then we come to sit and we make our cushion and our sitting place in our shrine look gorgeous, but we're quite ready to throw bombs at our neighbors or at people that don't treat us very well or anyone who comes here and has a critical view of how we do things. We don't want them to come back. Well, these are not friendly feelings. These are not conducive to a mind that is peaceful, forgiving, rooted in the Dhamma, rooted in wholesomeness, rooted in purification of the heart, and in the opening of the flower of the heart to the sun. The sun, what is the sun? If you make the Dhamma like the sun, does it choose? Does it only shine on nice people? It shines on everyone. Even a fly in the garbage gets the sun. And the ticks that bite us and make us sick, their moms think that they're the best creature in the world. So even when a tick bites us, we don't want to take it off and kill it. We have these special new tweezers that you can pick them off without just taking the head. We try to care for our environment, but the care of the mind, the same kind of care, is not to destroy the goodness within us, even in the slightest way. So we take all these precepts. The Buddha describes the path in a nutshell. Sila, samadhi, panya. You think that, oh, all this precept stuff, just formality at the beginning, it's the core of the whole thing. It's our map, our guideline. It's our BPS, our Buddha positioning system. Without precepts, we're lost. We're really in a desert where there's no oasis we will ever reach. But if we have precepts, it's like cleats on your feet. You can walk anywhere because you walk in virtue. People can bomb you, but they will never kill you because there's no you. They cannot destroy the truth that you hold through the purification of your heart. That's refuge. That is safety. Pure awareness of truth. That's who we are.